I bought into the model of career ascension. You go from better to better to better, and that's the direction things are supposed to go. More responsibility, better title, more money.
This is the Happen to Your Career podcast with Scott Anthony Barlow.
We help you stop doing work that doesn't fit you, figure out what does, and make it happen.
We help you define the work that is unapologetically you and then go get it.
If you feel like you were meant for more and you're ready to make a change, keep listening.
Here's Scott.
Here's Scott.
Here's Scott.
Why is our culture so obsessed with job titles and job status? Just think about how often we ask and are asked by others, "So, what do you do?" This inflated importance of career causes people to believe they have to find all of their fulfillment and everything they could possibly need within the constraints of their career, which can very easily lead to work consuming your entire life. And when, not if, when that all-consuming job begins conflicting with your priorities like health, family, whatever it may be, something will have to give. So then the question becomes, what is the life that you want to build? And where does work fit into that?
You know, I used to joke for years about, oh, look, it's 5 o'clock. I think I'll close down my computer and leave it here and come back the next day and not think about work. You know, as though that were sort of a fever dream. And now that's my life.
That's Karen Gutentag. Karen worked with the Peace Corps, was an associate dean of Middlebury College for 18 years, and then became the dean of students for a private boarding school. When the pandemic hit at the same time as multiple family emergencies, Karen realized her work was keeping her from her true priorities. This caused her to begin asking some pretty big questions about what she really wanted her life to look like. And ultimately, she took a career break from everything to figure that out. Karen challenged herself to deconstruct her belief around what work should be and realized that the roles that aligned with the life she wanted to live, well, they weren't as high status as her previous all-consuming roles had been. Now, if we fast forward to the end, Karen landed a new role that she loves that gives her all the components she was looking for in a career, as well as the time and space to be with her daughter and do other things she enjoys. But I just skipped a whole bunch of pretty important details, including a lot of challenges Karen overcame. So let's get into that conversation.
I was an English major out at a school in Minnesota, English and African American studies. And I remember sort of thinking, I guess this is kind of an important summer. This summer before I graduate, I should do something with it. So I went into the summer feeling like I really didn't know what I wanted to do, but I had this idea, you know, I'm an English major, African American studies, I should try publishing. And so, of course, this is, speaking of age, back in the time of the phone book. And I, you know, was living in Massachusetts and I had no idea how to find a job in publishing. So I actually opened up the phone book, literally, and called every publishing company in the state of Massachusetts, of which there were many, I must say, more than you might imagine, probably at least 30, and did my chippy little liberal arts graduate, you know, or liberal arts college student thing and said, hi, you know, I'm an English major and I'm interested in learning more about publishing. And would you be willing to create an internship for me this summer so I can work in your office and learn more about publishing? And I finally got a job with Zoland Books, the last publishing company listed in the phone book. That would be with a Z.
You went A to Z.
Literally.
All the way through.
Yes. And it ended up being great. And my next job, I sort of went about the same way in a new location. So it was kind of a tacky little operation, but I think it instilled within me this idea that I can create opportunities for myself. And that was pretty empowering. And that's exactly what I did after I graduated from college. I still didn't know what I wanted to do, but a friend and I decided we wanted to live in Portland, Maine. So that's where we went. And I called up all the publishing companies there. And lo and behold, I got a job with Intercultural Press, which was this publishing company that did all kinds of materials on multicultural, cross-cultural, international, intercultural topics. So topically, it was fantastic. The experience was completely demoralizing. And I probably shouldn't have said the name. It doesn't actually exist anymore. I think they went out of business, which is kind of shocking because they had like a niche market at that time.
Interesting.
Nobody else was doing this kind of stuff. But I was miserable. I was behind a computer the entire time. I was an editorial assistant and assistant to the president. I was making $8 an hour, which was tough going. And it was my first job after college. And I really had this sense of like, oh, this is going to tell me who I am as a professional. And my boss was really quite abusive. She was very unpredictable. And she really had me believing that it was a huge favor that she was even paying me a salary because I just had nothing to offer the world. So it was really crushing to me in terms of my sense of myself as a professional. But during that time, I was so miserable. I again sort of decided, all right, I'm going to research this. I'm going to figure out, I'm going to do the self-assessments. I'm going to go to the library. I'm going to do the tests and figure out what I want to do. I'm going to start informational interviewing with people, which was very helpful, and started to put together my list of criteria, which started with everything opposite from what I was currently experiencing.
That's always where it starts, right?
It was, yes. And I was really lucky because I don't know that it always happens this way, and it didn't really happen to me this time, but I had the experience of, you know, through a series of conversations and interviews and continuing to sort of zig and zag and hone and refine, I hit on the job. And I knew exactly what it was. And it was like the three cherries on the slot machine. And it checked off all of my boxes, which was college admissions. And I had all my different criteria, the events planning and doing something that felt meaningful and being in a beautiful environment and having variety and having. And one of the things was I wanted work that had a sense of completion at the end. You know, I found that when I was working on editorial stuff, we always had like seven or eight things going on at once. And there was no point at which you sort of said, ugh, we did it, you know, and now we're moving on to something else. We're growing something. We're changing. We're, you know, it just felt like it was sort of an endless cycle. So all of these different components. So I was in Portland, Maine, and not far from Bowdoin College. And I had gone to a small liberal arts college. And so I reached out to the director of admissions, who I did not know, dean of admissions, and asked him to go to coffee with me and did my little proposal, you know, and said, if I quit my job and I know I want to do admissions, I have no experience whatsoever, but it's what I really want to do. And if I quit my job and come volunteer for you, can you give me enough experience so that I can be a viable job candidate in the spring? And he said yes, and was no dummy, free labor. And so I ended up just doing this volunteering for 3 months. And I was right. I was just, it was everything that I wanted to do. And lo and behold, I was a viable job candidate. And there weren't any openings at Bowdoin that year, but there was an opening at Lafayette College and I got it. And then as soon as there was an opening at Bowdoin the next year, I came back and worked there for another 4 years. And I loved it. I was absolutely right about all the things that I would love. What I had not anticipated and what had not particularly been on my list of things that I was looking for was working with college students. I hadn't realized that that was any sort of component of the job, and it's not a huge component of the job, but I directed the tour guide program. So I worked with all of the student tour guides, and then I ultimately took on international admissions, and there was no point person at that time for international students. So I kind of became the de facto dean for international students. And all of the students that I got to know during the admissions process, I felt some sort of connection to and responsibility for. And we tended to do expanded programs for minoritized student populations. So yeah. I spent more time with them in the admissions process. So I had strong connections with them. So I was doing all of this deaning. which was not really my job, but I just loved working with these students. And I think for them, I was a person who they felt had kind of seen them through the process and knew where they came from and created some sense of affirmation and continuity for them. And people kept sort of saying, you should be a dean. This is like, why aren't you doing this? And part of me said, yep, this is what I love. This is what I want to do. But I had two qualms, one of which was that if I followed that path at that point in my life and went and got a graduate degree and then got a job as a dean at a place like Carleton or Bowdoin, that my whole life would be in these ivory towers. And I was 28 at the time, and I wasn't quite comfortable with that choice. And the other was that most of the students I was working with, as I said, were sort of the minoritized population or international students or in some way marginalized. And working with them was raising a lot of social justice issues that they were experiencing about inclusion, about community, about access and structural issues. And I wasn't totally sure if what I loved about working with them was the working with students part or all of the social justice issues and community problem solving and access issues. So I decided to punt and I joined the Peace Corps.
that is a left turn that I did not see coming in the story. I think I knew that was in there someplace. I didn't know that was... That was it.
That's where it was. And a big part of that was because I was working so closely with the international students. And I was just so inspired by their courage and the transformation and the challenges that they were experiencing going around the world to put themselves in these new environments. And I felt like I wanted to have that growth experience too. The Peace Corps conversation could take a really long time, so I'm not going to get into the details of the Peace Corps in great depth.
I'm curious also, what else took place that led up to you making this most recent career change?
The most recent career change, it was sort of the two-part change. So, you know, I was in the Peace Corps and then we were evacuated and then I worked for a nonprofit and then I was ready to become a dean and went to graduate school and became a dean and was at Middlebury College for 18 years. And that position ultimately unfolded in a way over a period of time that it was no longer meeting my needs. It was no longer pleasurable. I had sort of taken on a lot of work that nobody else really wanted to do that I actually happened to be quite passionate about. And that was the Title IX work.
Yeah.
But between that and doing student conduct work, both of which I cared about a great deal, but I found that the positions really compromised my ability to have the kind of relationships with students that I wanted. Mm. I was able to enact the structural changes that felt important to me and meaningful and felt like I was doing the right thing by students in building these programs and deepening them. But in the community itself, I felt increasingly isolated because when you are associated with Title IX work, you are associated with, you know, with student conduct work, you just don't have the same kinds of relationships with students. And it wasn't, in some ways, it wasn't appropriate for me to have those kinds of relationships with students. And in college administration, the higher you get, the less you're actually working with students, the more you're doing either crisis management or budget or politics or policy. And I felt like, okay, well, I like some of that. I like doing the structural change. I like thinking about systemic and cultural issues and all of that. But I don't want to sacrifice my ability to actually be working in the weeds with students. So it seemed like a good idea to take the dean of students position that I think at the college level would have had me more isolated and translate it to a high school level where I understood that I could do both. That the administrative machinery was not so deep that I couldn't both work really closely with students and also have some big picture responsibilities. And so it seemed like it was going to be a really great combination. And I also felt like I had the opportunity to kind of be in charge of a community in this way with all of the things that I had learned about student needs and students that I had seen show up in college really in need of certain skills and experiences and knowledge that they weren't getting in high school. I felt like, let me at this, like, this is awesome. I'm going to get to really create something special and build on a community and help them really to develop in ways that both will create a really meaningful experience for students at the high school level and set them up for success beyond. And I found a progressive school that really aligned with my value system. And I thought that I had just nailed it. And so as you do in a new job, you say, okay, well, let me just take some time to get the lay of the land first and then figure out how I can help and make sense and get a better sense of what the community's needs are and start to figure things out. So I took my first few months to do that. And then the pandemic hit. And then all bets were off. And it just became 2.5 years of reaction, of reactive work, of trying to help an institution navigate at a very human level and at an institution level, a global crisis. And from a position of responsibility in a community that I was really only beginning to understand, and everything that I knew about it was about to be changed. So it was a very, very challenging period of time. And it also, I'm a single mom and had a fourth grader who needed pretty full attention at the time when my job was requiring me to be literally all hands on deck all the time, living on campus and trying to parent her and help her to get through this experience in a way that was going to be best for her, while I was also responsible for 227 other students and the experience of the entire staff and faculty, you know, with a pretty small administrative team kind of doing all the decision making, was really quite impossible. And had a number of personal challenges occur along the way. It was a really unfortunate period of time where the first September, my best friend died.
Oh, wow.
The next fall, my mom got breast cancer. That winter, my dad died. That spring, my dog got cancer. I mean, it was just like, I just couldn't kind of get out of it. So by the middle of the third year, I had really wanted to stay for at least 4 years. I wanted to sort of see it through the crisis and help to rebuild, but I just was depleted on every level and was roadkill.
Well, I think at some point you have no more left to give too. So I understand the thought of being able to stay and finish it out. And I think that comes from a good place. Also, at the same time, it sounds like the state you were in at that point in time, you had given much of what you had been able to give and already served in that way. So what happened from there?
Yeah. Well, and I think for me, it also came down to, I just felt like I was an absentee parent. I felt like I was really, really, like my child was number 227 that I was responsible for. And that just was not okay. So I think my initial plan was, as I said, do what I've done before, you know, figure out what do I want more of? What do I want less of? What does that look like? And how do I get that job? But at that point, my whole landscape was just so different. It wasn't just, I need a new job. It was, everything. I don't even have the vision to figure out what that should be. I'm scrapping the whole plan. It's not about what I need more of and what I need less of. I just need this to stop. And I didn't have a vision for what was going to come next, which was different for me. Normally I had been able to kind of rely on that calculation to help me figure out with success.
Yes.
What was going to serve me better. And in this stage in my life, I was so exhausted that I couldn't even get there. And trying to do that while I was also in the middle of this chaos and still actually needing to show up as the dean of students. And while I was trying to ask these big life questions about where and what and how my life was going to look like, I didn't have the bandwidth to do it all. And several people had to tell me the same thing before it finally sunk in, that I just needed to put that off and say, you know what, get through the rest of this year and then take a break. And just, you can't catch the next trapeze because you can't catch anything right now. You need to drop in the net right now. And my mother was saintly enough to say, move back home. As I said, we'd lost my dad, and take as much time as you need to just regroup, figure things out, take your time so that you can make a really good decision. So that was a pretty important decision for me, to give up the idea, to get comfortable with the idea of being unemployed for a while. And psychologically, it was pretty uncomfortable, you know?
What was the most uncomfortable part for you?
Not having a great new shiny title to be able to say, I gave up this and now I'm doing this, you know? I think you sort of I bought into the model of career ascension. You go from better to better to better. And that's the direction things are supposed to go. More responsibility, better title, more money. And so going from being a Xena student to being unemployed and kind of losing that work identity for a significant period of time was hard for me. And not so hard that I wasn't willing to do it, but uncomfortable nonetheless, and something I kind of had to make peace with.
What helped you? Because I think that is a huge challenge we experience for many people that we get the opportunity to work with. And when we see that firsthand, a lot of times people expect it not to be as uncomfortable as it can be. That identity challenge that I can't now represent or, I don't know, hide behind, whatever way you want to look at it. But what specifically worked for you as you were maneuvering through that challenge?
Well, it hit me at different points. I mean, I guess I would say it was kind of a two-part experience.
Sure.
Part one was being unemployed.
Yep.
And part two was ultimately taking a position that on an org chart was a significant step down from my previous position. And they were two different but related challenges.
Yes.
And I would say probably what did help me to get through it? I mean, what helped me to, one thing was I did not have a choice. You know, I could not take a job right at the time I was leaving my previous job. I just was so exhausted. I was really roadkill. So I sort of had to. And I think what helped me was being able to articulate, being able to feel like I was still being productive, like I was on a journey. I wasn't just sort of hanging out, you know, I was actively trying to figure things out. I was actively working to explore possibilities and talk with people and reflect and read and research. And that was my full-time job. So I guess I always felt like there was motion. It wasn't just I was sitting on the couch watching TV waiting for something to fall into my lap. I was actively engaged in a process. And it was not always a clear process. I didn't have the cherries on the slot machine experience that we talked about earlier of being like, I know what I want and I know how to get it. And that was really hard too. So I would say for that stage of it, the unemployment stage, it was getting comfortable with my elevator speech, I guess, of being able to say, I left a job and I'm really not sure where I'm going next. So I'm taking the time I'm really lucky to have the time to be able to really figure it out and do some thoughtful research before I make my next move. And that's where I'm at right now.
Yeah. Let's talk about the process of career change this time around. So Specifically, you mentioned that in the past, you sort of knew what to do and had certainly some experiences that had caused you to build confidence in how to make past changes. This time around, the season of life was very, very different. And one of the things you and I chatted very briefly about before we started recording was the idea of it being too late. And I think that this is part of why many people feel like it is too late in some ways to make another significant change in one way or another in your, not just career, but life. And so I guess what I'm curious about for you is what caused you to feel like this was a must for you, and what was so different in this season of life for you compared to previous?
I think in my previous job exploration moments and job shifts, my primary questions had been, what do I most want to be doing now? What job is going to be the closest to the optimal reflection of work that matters to me, that I think is important, that allows me to use all of the skills that I love the most in a community that's going to be a great environment to work in, with a salary that's going to allow me a certain lifestyle that I want.
Sure.
And I am really lucky that I've been able to have positions like that. And this time around, I realized that that could not be, I think I wanted it. I think when I first started the job search, that's what I was aiming for. And I realized that that calculation was just not reflective of what my needs were at this stage in my life, that I really needed to take into account my health, my emotional health, my physical health, my child, and the level of availability that I wanted and needed to have for her after school and in the evening and on weekends, both sort of temporal availability and emotional availability. And that if I were solely going for the job based on that initial goal of me and most fulfilling to me and the work that's going to be perfectly hitting my challenge level and, you know, the right level of responsibility and all of that, that in all of my past experiences, that's not 9-to-5 work. You know, that is high stress, high responsibility, often evenings, often weekends, and often emotionally entangling kind of work that was really incompatible with the kind of availability and focus that I knew I really needed to offer to my child at this stage in life. And having to sort of realize that, that I was not going to be able to thread that needle was a really big aha moment for me. And a little bit of a sad one, but a really important one.
What made it sad for you? Was that back to the how you viewed it in your identity, or was it something else?
I think a couple of things. Logistically, I realized that what that meant was that in order to live independently, I was going to need to get a job that paid that much and that involved that much responsibility. And that the idea of taking on that big a job in order to live independently was going to mean I wasn't going to be able to be the kind of parent I wanted to be as a single mom, that I couldn't do all of those things, that if she and I were still aiming for independent living, I was going to need an all-absorbing job. And that the trade-off was therefore going to be the parenting that was a primary motivation for making the change. And I couldn't figure out how to check all those boxes. Again, it felt like I was trying to thread a needle, a job with all of these great qualities and meeting all of my professional needs that was also going to let me leave at 5 and have plenty of flexibility on the afternoons where I needed to, you know, drive her around or whatever and not take homework on the weekend. I don't think it exists. Or if it does exist in a way that would appeal to me, I couldn't find it. And so I realized that I was going to have to make some trade-offs, and that if I really wanted to prioritize my child and my own health and well-being, I needed to decide that I wasn't going to be able to live independently, that we were going to stay living with my mom at least for the next 5 years for her to get through high school in ways that would allow me to take a lower paying, lower stress job in order to prioritize the availability for her and my parenting and my health. And it's interesting, that concept came to me right before Philip actually recommended a book to me that kind of crystallized that idea, a lot of what I'd been thinking and experiencing, which was The Good Enough Job, you know, which is not rocket science, but he pulls together the themes very effectively of the perils of all of the reasons why we have developed in this culture and in many cultures in ways that center our work as the primary focus of our identity. And everything else sort of revolves around our work identity. And we look to work to meet so many of our needs around our sense of efficacy and our social agendas and our political agendas and our professional growth and our sense of purpose. And when we put all of those eggs in one basket and the basket falls, then all of these different dimensions of your life are implicated, which was exactly what I had experienced in the last 20 years of my career, both in my job at the college and my job at the boarding school, was everything focused on my work life. And I mean, in the boarding school, I was literally living at work. You know, it wasn't their work life separation was not a possibility.
It was not a thing.
Right. And so from this book, you know, what he talks about is really the importance of rethinking what role do you want work to play in your life? And how can you ensure that all of the other dimensions of your life are rich and meaningful and areas that you can develop independent of whatever it is that allows you to earn money?
Yes.
And not look to your work to be all of those things. And making that shift was what allowed me to say, okay, I'm going to find a job that I think will be enjoyable, that will allow me to go back to, for me, what was the core of why I got into higher ed in the first place. And that was working with students and come in at a level of responsibility that is not going to overwhelm the rest of my life. That's going to allow me to really prioritize these other areas. In a million years, I did not see myself living with my mother in my childhood home in the suburbs of Massachusetts, you know, but also coming to recognize that for my daughter, being in this period of limbo was really having a poor effect on her, that she was in this prolonged state of in a new community. You know, she just started a brand new middle school in seventh grade, coming from a school in which she was, you know, one of 12 sixth graders to being in a 900 person middle school. And this experience of not knowing when she was going to leave and if she was going to leave and where she was going to go and what was coming next and how long she was going to stay was making it very hard for her to actually put down roots in this community and plug into her school experience and plug into her social experiences and her friendships. And I really saw that, and that she really needed the stability of knowing where she was going to be for the next few years. And that I had to make a career decision that was going to meet not just my needs, but her needs, which I'd never really had to make before. I, other than that, most of my career decisions were meeting her needs to the extent that it was allowing me to live independently. That's what it meant, and not travel. And this time it meant staying where we were in a good school system, in a financial situation that would allow me to take a job that would let me be available to her. And that's been, it's not what I thought this stage of life would look like. And yet, I have to remind myself of all, you know, there are trade-offs for sure, but this is actually the healthiest that I have ever been. I mean, you know, I used to joke for years about, oh, look, it's 5 o'clock. I think I'll close down my computer and leave it here and come back the next day and not think about work. You know, as though that were sort of a fever dream. And now that's my life. I have, in taking a smaller job and a more flexible job, I'm able to show up for her in ways that really matter right now. And at this, it is. And at the same time, I find that I still have some old tapes playing, that there are times at work where, you know, my work is fun and simple most of the time. I work directly with students and I'm a sort of coach advisor. I support a great population of international students. And my job is to help them figure out what they need and how to get it and what they want and personal growth and development. So it is pretty easy. And if I get sick or if I need to change a meeting because I've got to pick up my kid or whatever that may be, it is flexible. It is super flexible. I get to work from home 2 days a week, which was not even on my dance card, you know.
Amazing.
But that's pretty amazing. And there are times when I sort of forget what it is that I'm looking for from this job. And I think, oh, but is it fulfilling enough? And how will I grow? And how will I make these, you know, these sense of contribution. And I have to remind myself, almost manually shift the gears and say, that's not why you took this job. You took this job to meet different needs. And if you are feeling like you need a sense of fulfillment in your life, you need to look, you need to create that for yourself outside of your job. And so that's kind of the process that I'm more actively engaged in right now, even as I sometimes forget that I didn't take this job to fill all the space that my previous jobs used to fill.
What advice would you give to someone who's in that situation where they're trying to figure out what does the next stage of life look like?
I think it's being willing to really radically re-examine the role that you want work to play in your life, what your needs are, way beyond what your work needs are, you know, and really recognize how many of your life needs have you assumed were going to be met through your work, maybe because they have been, or maybe because you always wanted them to be, and not make premature assumptions that they have to be met in your work position. And I think also just really debunking this idea that for everyone at every stage of your life, in every circumstance, that perfect job is out there that could meet all of your personal and professional and emotional and political and financial needs. And it doesn't mean that all of those needs might not be met, but they might not all be met through your job. And not feel like you're compromising if you take a position that is allowing you to meet the needs that are your top priorities, and recognizing that there are trade-offs, and that you want to be thoughtful about your trade-offs and make sure that your trade-offs, that you are making the decisions and compromises that are going to allow you to meet your priorities, and that sometimes that's not every single dimension of your life happening all at once at this particular moment.
Most of the episodes you've heard on Happen to Your Career showcase stories of people that have taken the steps to identify and land careers that they are absolutely enamored with, that match their strengths and are really what they want in their lives. If that's something that you're ready to begin taking steps towards, that's awesome. And we want to figure out how we can help. So here's what I would suggest. Take the next 5 seconds to open up your email app and email me directly. I'm going to give you my personal email address, scott@happentoyourcareer.com. Just email me and put conversation in the subject line. And when you do that, I'll introduce you to someone on our team who can have a super informal conversation with, and we'll figure out the very best type of help for you, whatever that looks like, and the very best way that we can support you to make it happen. So send me an email right now with conversation in the subject line. Here's a sneak peek into what we have coming up in store for you next week.
I had to think through the worst case scenario and realize that worst case, I would be okay. I would leave the company. I would go figure out something else to do, and it would be fine.
Big decisions. You know how these work. Our brains usually fight us and they want us to stay in our comfort zones. Plus, if you're like me, you can turn nearly anything into logic. Yes, I know I'm not loving work and my boss is way overbearing, but there could be another opportunity 4 months from now. Many people find themselves torn when it comes to a choice like staying in the same place versus making a career change. They know, you might even know, and feel deep down inside that something's not right, but we still struggle with taking a chance to actually make a change. Why on earth do we fight what we know to be true in our core? That's the question we're going to dig into today. We see how others reach their goals and we think we must follow in their footsteps to reach the same success. But the truth is, we don't have to follow them. If you want to take more control of your life, this episode is absolutely for you. All that and plenty more next week right here on Happen to Your Career. Make sure that you don't miss it. And if you haven't already, click subscribe on your podcast player so that you can download this podcast in your sleep and you get it automatically. Even the bonus episodes every single week, sometimes multiple times a week. Until next week, adios. I'm out.